From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
My client wrote a letter to the editor being critical of the administration's handling of Hurricane Katrina and the Iraq War. As a result, she was accused of sedition, which should never have happened.
We will look at why a local VA nurse was investigated for sedition. The Veterans Administration seized her hard drive after she wrote a letter to the editor criticizing the Bush administration. New Mexico is at the center of President Bush's push to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons. We'll talk to Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group. And we'll look at the ongoing battle over uranium mining in the Navajo Nation.
Without any public hearings, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission granted permission for the deadly carcinogen to be mined right next to Crown Point schools and churches.
I don't understand NRC, the United States government, why they could do this again, why they would have a mining like this near our community.
Plus, the music of Iraqi-born oud player Rahim Alhaj here in studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Associated Press has obtained confidential video footage of President Bush's final briefing before Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast. It shows the president was given dire warnings the storm could breach levees and threaten the lives of residents of New Orleans. The briefing occurred on August 28th, one day before Katrina hit. On the video, President Bush is seen watching the briefing via a video conference from his Texas ranch. The president does not ask one single question throughout the briefing, yet concludes with this optimistic remark.
I want to assure the folks at the state level that we are fully prepared to not only help you during the storm, but we will move in whatever resources and assets we have at our disposal after the storm to help you deal with the loss of property, and we pray for no loss of life, of course.
The video shows several federal, state, and local officials issuing the warnings. Then FEMA head Michael Brown tells the president and Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff about his concerns for evacuees.
My gut tells me, I told you guys, my gut was that this is a bad one and a big one. Everyone within FEMA is actually on call. This is, put it mildly, the big one, I think. As you may or may not know, the Superdome is about 12 feet below sea level. So I don't know what the heck. And I also learned about that roof. I don't know whether that roof is designed to withstand a Cat 5 hurricane. So not to be kind of gross here, but I'm concerned about NDMS and medical and DMORT assets and their respond to a catastrophe within a catastrophe.
At another point in the briefing, a weather expert issues this warning on Katrina's potential effects.
Also want to make absolutely clear to everyone that the greatest potential for large loss of life is still in the coastal areas from the storm surge.
The video obtained by the Associated Press cast further doubt over the White House's claim it wasn't adequately warned about Katrina's possible magnitude. On September 1st, President Bush said, quote, "I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees. They did anticipate a serious storm, but these levees got breached, and as a result, much of New Orleans is flooded, and now we're having to deal with it and will," unquote. After viewing the video, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin said, quote, "I have kind of a sinking feeling in my gut right now. From this tape, it looks like everybody was fully aware," he says. The White House is already trying to downplay the video. Presidential spokesperson Trent Duffy said, quote, "I hope people don't draw conclusions from the president getting a single briefing." Earlier this week, before the video was released, President Bush was interviewed by ABC News' Elizabeth Vargas.
When you look back on those days immediately following when Katrina struck, what moment do you think was the moment that you realized that the government was failing, especially the people of New Orleans?
When I saw TV reporters interviewing people who were screaming for help. The scenes looked chaotic and desperate. And I realized that our government was I could have done a better job of comforting people.
Meanwhile, in an interview with the Associated Press, former FEMA head Michael Brown dismissed Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff's assertion that the Bush administration's response was hampered by the, quote, fog of war. Brown said, quote, "It was a fog of bureaucracy. My entreaties to the White House about the problems that FEMA was having were falling on deaf ears," he said. In Pakistan, four people were killed when a suicide bomber attacked a vehicle near the U.S. consulate in Karachi. One U.S. diplomat was among the dead. Another 50 people were reported injured. The attack comes ahead of President Bush's visit to Pakistan later this week. In India, tens of thousands of people continued their massive protests against the visit of President Bush. In one of several rallies, victims of the 1984 gas leak from the U.S.-owned Union Carbide pesticide factory demonstrated in Bhopal. This is a member of the Bhopal Gas Victims Association. A member of the Gas Victims Association spoke about the disaster there. Over 20,000 died in the aftermath of the Bhopal gas tragedy, while another 100,000 people suffered lasting health problems. In Nigeria, six foreign oil workers, including one U.S. citizen, have been released after a two-week kidnapping ordeal. Their captors, members of the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, are demanding more local control over oil resources and the release of political prisoners. Three other hostages, two Americans and a man from Britain, remain in captivity. The released American worker, Mako Hawkins, said he sympathized with his captors and harbored no ill will towards them. In other news, the State Department quietly announced this week it's requested $100 million for Iraqi reconstruction, all of it for prisons. The Bush administration initially promised $20 billion to reconstruct Iraqi infrastructure, but much of the money has been diverted to security. State Department Iraq Coordinator James Jeffrey said the $100 million prison project was the lone new reconstruction effort the U.S. government will undertake over the next year. Back in the United States, the city of New York has reached a settlement with 22 prisoners that includes new citywide measures controlling the use of force by prison guards. New York agreed to pay a total of $2.2 million to 22 prisoners who suffered serious injuries at the hands of city prison guards. Under the agreement, New York will also modify its rules on the use of force, place hundreds of new video cameras to monitor guard behavior, and overhaul its mechanisms to investigate abuses. In mining news, the New York Times is reporting the Bush administration has decreased the fines for major mining companies and failed to collect fines on nearly half the mine safety violations issued under its watch. Mine safety regulation has come under increased scrutiny with the deaths of 24 miners this year alone. Tony Apigard, a former top official at the Mine Safety and Health Administration, said, quote, "The Bush administration ushered in this desire to develop cooperative ties between regulators and the mining industry. Safety has certainly suffered as a result," he said. In other news, Europe's top human rights watchdog urged member states Wednesday to better monitor the CIA's practice of transferring detainees on European soil. The Council of Europe's Secretary General Terry Davis said Europe has become a, quote, "happy hunting ground for foreign intelligence activities." Davis said, quote, "very few countries seem to have adopted an adequate and effective way to monitor who and what is transiting through their airports and airspace. What has allegedly happened is illegal under the internal law of all our member states," he said. And in New York, a group of protesters stood up and held signs as UN Ambassador John Bolton gave a speech at New York University on Wednesday. One sign read, quote, "U.S. interests, torture, illegal war, secret abductions, racial profiling, war crimes, among others," and quoted Bolton's infamous statement that, quote, "diplomacy is not an end in itself if it does not advance U.S. interests." During the speech, Bolton appeared to go further than the Bush administration's previous stated position on India and Pakistan's nuclear weapons. Bolton said the countries had acquired the weapons, quote, "legitimately." Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. The music, Rahim Alhaj, joining us in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Iraqi-born oud player who has been playing through this country, and his music is heard throughout the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we are on the verge of an exciting time. Those were the recent words of the nation's top nuclear weapons executive, Linton Brooks. Here in New Mexico, the center of the country's nuclear weapons program, a new nuclear age appears to be on the horizon. President Bush recently asked Congress for $27 million to help jumpstart the country's first new nuclear weapons program in two decades. The money will be used to fund a competition between the Los Alamos and the Lawrence Livermore laboratories to find and design a new generation of nuclear bombs to replace the country's entire nuclear arsenal. Meanwhile, in another major development in the country's quest for nuclear weapons, the U.S. and Britain conducted a joint underground nuclear test at the Nevada test site last week. Anti-nuclear activists, including the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, denounced the test, the first in nearly 2 years. In Hiroshima, the Peace Watchtower at the Peace Memorial Museum, which displays the number of days since the last nuclear test, was reset to zero. We're joined here in our Albuquerque studio at KNME by Greg Mello. He is director of the Los Alamos Study Group. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Well, a number of developments to ask you about. First, I want to start with President Bush in India right now and the latest news on this international nuclear rivalry between India and Pakistan.
Right. President Bush would like to use nuclear technology as part of a geopolitical strategy and views India as a country we can do business with in nuclear technology specifically and more broadly, of course. This is part of a discriminatory approach to nuclear weapons that is undermining our attempts to roll back potential proliferation in Iran and North Korea. It's hard for us to win friends while we are pumping up India's nuclear program, allowing it to go forward, turning a blind eye, meanwhile out here in New Mexico, preparing to manufacture a new generation of nuclear weapons, and then coming down so hard on Iran, Iran can enrich uranium under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. I don't think there's any ambiguity about that. But the United States cannot make a new generation of nuclear weapons under the Nonproliferation Treaty.
And yet it is?
Yeah, we are planning on it, yes.
Can you talk about this new generation and what it means here for New Mexico?
Sure.
I mean, some have said that if New Mexico were to secede from the United States, it would be the world's third greatest nuclear power.
Right. There's about 2,500 nuclear weapons just 5 miles from here, just a little south of the main runway.
Where?
At Kirtland Air Force Base at the Albuquerque Sunport, the main airport there. The $27 million that the administration is requesting for a new warhead program, which it calls the Reliable Replacement Warhead, is really just the tip of the iceberg. The acronym RRW appears 60 times in the nuclear weapons budget, sprinkled around in different line items, and those line items can be redirected toward or to support the so-called RRW, or Reliable Replacement Warhead Program. So the actual budget is quite a bit more. The intent is to redirect the Stockpile Stewardship Program, or to say it another way, to use the fruits of the Stockpile Stewardship Program to go ahead and upgrade the U.S. nuclear arsenal, not just directly in terms of the explosives, the nuclear explosives or warheads, but to initiate a broad pattern of innovation so that the warheads can keep pace with innovation in the delivery systems and with targeting and with arming, firing, fusing, so that basically so that nuclear weapons can continue to evolve and remain a central part of the goal of so-called full-spectrum dominance.
You're saying that the new generation of nuclear weapons that the Bush administration is pushing forward violates the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty?
Absolutely. And in that treaty, we are required to successfully negotiate complete nuclear disarmament. This has been a U.S. law since 1970. As recently as 2000, the United States, in a consensus statement at the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference, we agreed to proceed in with nuclear disarmament in a series of 13 steps that would actually implement that disarmament requirement. The Bush administration has repudiated those 13 steps, and the subject of nuclear disarmament and our Article 6 requirement to do so under the NPT is not something the Bush administration wants to talk about, especially in the context of Iran and the we would like to hold Iran to a very high standard under the NPT. Ourselves, we would not want to talk about what we're doing there.
Greg Mello, who runs Los Alamos? Who runs the
Right now, it's the University of California, but a consortium of four companies. Three companies and the University of California just won the contract, and so we're in a transition phase. I think it's June 1st. The transition is to be complete. So soon, Bechtel, Washington Group International.
These are corporations.
BWXT and the University of California will run Los Alamos National Laboratory. They have a what could be a 20-year no-bid contract. It's about $2.2 billion per year. So it's a $40 billion no-bid contract if they do what they're told.
And what's the significance of this?
Well, we've never seen this kind of profit motive in the nuclear weapons business up to now. They can make more than $1 billion, more than $1.5 billion in fees, in management awards. Plus, they get an entree or leg up in the nuclear power business, which they expect to be growing. Los Alamos has for years, along with Sandia National Laboratory here, had a program to promote nuclear power worldwide. And it sounds quite similar to what was incorporated in the President's State of the Union address.
U.S. and Britain, this nuclear test mm-hmm. that they conducted at the Nevada test site.
Yes.
Can you explain what they did? Was this a surprise?
No, it wasn't a surprise. I can't explain exactly what they did because I'm not sure. But the basic idea is that Britain is poised to make a decision about upgrading its Trident warhead system, its submarine-launched missiles, which are the only kind it has. The United States is also involved in upgrading its Trident warheads. The two warheads are very close together. The two programs are intermeshed. Lockheed, which runs Sandia here, is a partner in running the British nuclear weapons program as well. So they're institutionally enmeshed. And, of course, they're politically enmeshed, as we know. So what's going on here is that the Brits and the United States nuclear weapons program don't want to get out of sync. If we upgrade, they'll upgrade, I think is They don't want to be left behind technologically. So we have kind of an arms race going on.
We only have 30 seconds, but the significance of this, and for example, the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki speaking out.
Yeah, the significance of this are basically that we're eroding the norms against nuclear weapons worldwide. The rest of the world knows all about this, and we can't achieve a diplomatic consensus against nuclear weapons if we undermine the existing strong international norms against nuclear weapons. But if we insist on their legitimacy, we insist on being able to threaten with them, then from the Bush administration's perspective, all that's left for them are military options to deal with proliferation. So our options are decreased.
Greg Mello, I want to thank you very much for joining us of the Los Alamos Study Group based in New Mexico, right here where we're broadcasting. We're broadcasting from the studios of KNME in Albuquerque. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Rahim Alhaj, playing his oud here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where we're broadcasting from. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has moved a step closer to renewing the Patriot Act. The Senate voted 84-15 on Wednesday to end a filibuster led by Wisconsin Senator Russell Feingold. After Wednesday's vote, Feingold proceeded to read the Bill of Rights from the Senate floor. Feingold has long called on the Senate to add measures to preserve civil liberties. Here in Albuquerque, a local Veterans Affairs nurse has felt the crackdown on civil liberties firsthand. In September, shortly after Hurricane Katrina struck, Laura Berg wrote a letter to The Alibi, a local newspaper, criticizing the Bush administration's handling of Hurricane Katrina as well as the Iraq War. Berg wrote, quote, "As a VA nurse working with returning vets, I know the public has no sense of the additional devastating human and financial costs of post-traumatic stress disorder." She urged readers to, quote, "act forcefully to remove a government administration playing games of smoke and mirrors and vicious deceit." The response to Laura Berg's letter was harsh. Her office computer was seized. The government announced it was investigating her for sedition. That's right, sedition. VA Human Resources Chief Mel Hooker wrote in a letter to Berg, quote, "The agency is bound by law to investigate and pursue any act which potentially represents sedition." To date, the VA has yet to issue a public apology to Berg, but pressure is building. In Washington, New Mexico Senator Jeff Bingaman has asked Veterans Affairs Secretary James Nicholson to thoroughly investigate the VA's actions. Bingaman wrote, quote, "In a democracy, expressing disagreement with the government's actions does not amount to sedition or insurrection. It is and must remain protected speech," he wrote. Today, Laura Berg joins us here in Albuquerque in her first broadcast interview. We're also joined by Larry Cronin, an attorney with the New Mexico chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we welcome you both to
Thank
Democracy
you.
Now.
Thanks, Amy.
Laura, talk about the letter that you wrote to your local paper, The Alibi. When did you write it?
I wrote the letter within a week after Katrina hit the coast, and I had been just devastated by the scenes that I saw there. I was watching. Actually, it was my first experience to really be thoroughly exploring alternative media, actually reports right from the people on the streets as far as their experiences of abandonment. The scenes that were so much like a third world country, I think we've been really privileged in this country and not had to see close-up experiences like that. Just absolutely devastating. I've been a VA nurse for 15 years.
Where do you work?
I work in behavioral health at the local VA in the outpatient area.
And what's your specialty?
My specialty right now is working on call for emergencies, mental health emergencies. In the past, I've worked as doing mental health assessment for new patients. And, of course, that would be many returning vets from the Persian Gulf or from the current conflict.
And so you wrote this letter?
Pardon?
So you wrote a letter.
I wrote this letter. I think, I have all of us at the VA, there's very many compassionate people working there, very many dedicated people, and we've worked with, veterans from Vietnam, veterans from Korea, veterans from World War II. We were seeing more and more World War II veterans, triggered for the first time by Iraq. And actually, having memories and nightmares coming out.
You're saying now that they're triggered.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So World War II vets are coming in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So
and
we're seeing...
What are the complaints?
Just nightmares, not able to sleep, more tension, anxiety, irritability, aggressiveness, some detachment, from reality in the present time. Those kind of things. I'm just saying that these things together to me, really, really came together when I saw Katrina. I was aware that, money to protect the levees, to protect the Gulf Coast had been diverted to the war. Also, excuse me, I'm dry. The National Guardsmen, had been diverted to the war. And there was no response, and we say that we're fighting to... for the land of the free and the home of the brave, and we have homeland security. And I was really just overwhelmed, and I wrote a letter.
Is this the first time you've written a letter?
That's the first time I've written a letter of that nature.
And so you wrote it a week or two after Katrina hit?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it got published?
It got published within a week or two, yes. Mm-hmm.
What was the response?
It was published... And then it was a couple days interim, and I went into work on a Monday. I immediately had coworkers come to me and say, "We really supported your letter, but you may be in trouble, and you need to go to the union immediately." I went to the union, and I was told by the union that I had been reported up, my letter and me had been reported up through VA channels to the FBI.
To the FBI.
To the FBI. And, as a direct response to my publication of this letter.
Were you surprised?
Oh, I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. I was unbelieving. I was frightened, very, very frightened. And I felt this was, intimidation, And it was, I was told that it wasn't really, it was just through channels, it wasn't anything really against me personally, just that my letter came in on a search engine, it was sent up, it wasn't really any local. However, it was a week later, that approximately a week later, I was sitting at my desk, and there was a knock on the door. And my information security representatives came to impound my computer. They served me with a memo saying there was a belief I'd written this on my work computer and that that would be a misuse of government equipment. So I guess I could say I was, at that point it was local. It was about me, it was about my letter, and there was local repercussions. This was a memo written by our human resources director, Mr. Hooker.
We're talking to Laura Berg, who is a Veterans Affairs nurse here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who wrote a letter to her local paper concerned about the Bush administration's dealing with Hurricane Katrina as well as the war in Iraq. So you had your computer seized?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was taken. I was in the middle of writing, you know, my notes for the patients I'd seen. The computer was taken. And, of course, I asked, is there some other computer for me to do my work? And no one had thought about that. And it was returned, you know, within a day. But I understand the hard drive. And I do know now that the hard drive was removed and examined. And I have to say, you know, this is an incredibly frightening experience to be told that you're reported to the FBI. That can mean, under the current Patriot Act, sneak and peek. I mean, my home can be, you know, people can go in. I could be followed. My phone could be tapped. It was just a chilling experience. And also for my coworkers, too, I have to say.
Why? What has happened to them?
Well, people, you know, I mean, we believe we have, you know, First Amendment right to free speech, but we have been, to have harassment or intimidation.
Are they afraid?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And I've actually had calls and emails from federal employees across the nation, you know, in support and, you know, thanking me for being brave, you know, to actually, number one, write the letter, and number two, to actually say this is not right.
Let me bring Larry Cronin into this.
Sure, please.
The American Civil Liberties Union. The significance of what has happened to Laura Berg, VA nurse, writes, where did you write the letter?
I wrote it at home.
Writes a letter.
Absolutely.
And does that even matter? But writes a letter at home to her local paper concerned about government policy.
I don't think it really matters where she wrote it. Of course, the VA has a right to check their own computers. They own it. But the pretense of coming in and saying that they had a belief that she wrote it on their computer, and when Laura wrote them asking what's the basis of your belief, they wrote back saying, we believe because we believe you did it. There was no reasonable belief that she did it. So there's a level of intimidation, and I think it's a wave of intimidation that's going on throughout the country in chilling people's free speech, going from the protests that happened after we invaded Iraq and the violence from the law enforcement against those protests to Cindy Sheehan being arrested at the State of the Union address.
Wearing a T-shirt,
not protesting, not making any vocal protests. And there's other incidents throughout the country of these intimidation factors going on. And even though there was no adverse employment action against Laura, there's a chilling effect of free speech.
Laura, when did you start hearing the word sedition being thrown around?
I had been reported to the FBI, as is the report I had. Again, my computer was taken, and I decided I really did need to write a memo to the director and to Mr. Hooker and ask on what basis had these actions been taken. I received the memo back from
And
well, Mr.
now Mr. Hooker,
Hooker
is mm-hmm. Mel Hooker, Chief of Human
yes.
Resources.
Mm-hmm. Who's still in his position, by the way.
In Veterans Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Dowling, the director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they also said,
That's the first we heard the term sedition
right.
being used.
Right, exactly.
In the memo that they wrote in response to Laura's memo on November 9th, they wrote, which... the excerpt which you quoted, that they have bound by law to investigate and pursue any act which potentially represents sedition. And at that point, it was just over the top.
Exactly.
What does sedition mean?
It's basically taking, advocating the forceful, violent overthrow of the government.
And what penalty do you face?
Years in jail.
So where does this go from here? Your senator has taken this up, Senator Bingaman.
Yes, and I do want to say, when I wrote this letter, I sent it to Senator Bingaman, and I sent it to Senator Domenici, as well as to the alibi, and So he has written to the Secretary of the Veteran Affairs again, saying that he would like an investigation, you know, and he would like some retraining of VA employees. I think you have that in front of you. You can actually. We're asking for a public apology. We really want the VA to be able to say this. This is wrong, what we did, and we would like the rest of the federal employees to hear that across the country.
Let me read again from the memo of November 9th from the Chief of Human Resources Management Service. In your letter to the editor of the Weekly Alibi, the memo says, you declared yourself a VA nurse and publicly declared the government which employs you to have tragically misplaced priorities in criminal negligence and advocated act forcefully to remove a government administration playing games of smoke and mirrors and vicious deceit. The agency is bound by law to investigate and pursue any act which potentially represents sedition. You are reminded that government equipment is just that, and the government may apprehend, investigate, use, or permit the use of such at its discretion and direction. Signed, Mel Hooker, Chief Human Resources Management Service. Your response to this letter saying to investigate you for sedition?
Amy, I did not sign away my First Amendment rights as a citizen, you know, by choosing to serve in the federal government, you know, and choosing to serve veterans and care for people that have been wounded like this, you know. And this letter sounds like something from a totalitarian regime, you know, that we're supposedly going in and share our democracy. This is way out of line. This is way out of line. I have a right to speak my opinion. I have a right to say I'm a VA nurse. I do not speak for the VA. I speak as a public citizen. And I think the attorneys and the support across the country, because we really need to speak out about this. This is really, really frightening.
Is there a next step you will be taking?
Right now, Larry, we're waiting. We put in a Freedom of Information request to the FBI. We're waiting for a response from that.
That request is to find out what?
What information they have about Laura, about her computer, about this incident. We did receive the quickest response from the VA to our Freedom of Information Act, and they didn't have any extra information that we didn't already have that we got in their response. So right now, we're waiting to see what response we have from the FBI. Of course, we still stand. We're asking for a public apology. And we join Senator Bingaman in asking for a policy directive, letting the VA and the VA officials and administration across the country, but especially here in Albuquerque, that the First Amendment still exists here in the country, mm-hmm. and to cease these intimidation.
Are you concerned about speaking out today and this first time in this national broadcast, Laura Berg?
Yes, I am, Amy. And, you know, as I say, subsequent to these memos, I've had a personal discussion with Mary Dowling, and she has said, you know.
And again, her position at
the VA. She is my director at the Albuquerque VA, and she said, you know, you may express your opinion, but we prefer that you do not say you're a VA nurse. And so I am saying I'm a VA nurse. And some of my fire in writing this letter about Katrina in Iraq is from my experience as a VA nurse. I'm stepping off the edge here, and I do feel that it is some jeopardy to me in my position. But at this point, it's more important for me to say this, you know. And if I have to risk my job. The VA is going to lose an excellent commission, you know, that does not bring politics into the workplace, you know, and is a very caring person. And this country, you know, will lose many, many dedicated, caring people, you know, if this continues. And, I mean, we're going to lose a lot more than that. We're going to lose a whole lot.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Laura Berg, VA nurse here in Albuquerque. Thanks for joining us, and thank you very much, Larry Cronin of the Albuquerque American Civil Liberties Union. And the transcript of today's show, of course, posted on our website, and you can watch it, audio stream it at democracynow.org. NewsHour.org. And we'll continue to follow up and find out what does happen. And I thank you very much for having the courage to join us on Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we go to break with Albuquerque's Iraqi oud player, Rahim Ahaj. Broadcasting from New Mexico. Rahim Ahaj is playing his oud here at KNME Studios in Albuquerque. Yes, we're broadcasting from New Mexico, home to the Navajo Nation. For decades, they've been fighting an ongoing battle against uranium mining on their land. Last April, Navajo Nation President Joe Shirley approved legislation banning uranium mining on Navajo territory. There's currently no mining on the Navajo reservation, but Hydro Resources, Inc. has been working with the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission for years to try to get approval for mining near Navajo communities of Crown Point and Church Rock here in New Mexico. The company estimates nearly 100 million pounds of uranium exists on those sites, making it worth millions of dollars. Uranium mining occurred on the Navajo reservation for over 50 years, and the impact is still being felt. The land has been dotted with contaminated tailings and hundreds of abandoned mines that have not been cleaned up. There have been few studies on the health effects in reservation communities, but Navajos have suffered from high cancer rates and respiratory problems. One study has found that cancer rates among Navajo teens living near mine tailings are 17 times the national average. The Navajo reservation is home to more than 180,000 people. Over half the population lives below the U.S. poverty line. The group Eastern Navajo Dine Against Uranium Mining, or ENDALM, and the Southwest Research and Information Center have been fighting mining company HRI for over a decade in court. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the directors of both groups. But first, we turn to an excerpt of the documentary Homeland that takes a look at the battle against uranium mining in Crown Point and Church Rock. It's produced by Katahdin Foundation. This excerpt begins with the co-founder of ENDALM, Rita Capitan.
In 1994, in the evening, we were here at home, and Mitchell brought the paper home, as he does every day, and we both read it about two or three times in disbelief that uranium mining is to begin in Crown Point and Church Rock. They're starting up again.
From here, you can see the whole town of Crown Point. Mitchell and Rita live just below the water tank there in the distance, and as you can see, very, very close to where the Hydro Resources Incorporated plans to put the uranium mine.
Without any public hearings, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission granted permission for the deadly carcinogen to be mined right next to Crown Point schools and churches.
I don't understand NRC, the United States government, why they could do this again, why they would have a mining like this near our community.
The NRC had granted permission for the Texas-based company to conduct the mining with a process called in-situ leach mining.
The mining company intends to inject chemicals down into the aquifer next to the community water supply. Those chemicals will leach or strip the uranium off of the rock into the aquifer, creating basically a toxic soup.
Rita start to ask me question, isn't this what you have worked before, you know, this kind of mining, in-situ leach mining? I said, yeah.
Mitchell worked as a lab technician for Mobil Oil in the 1980s.
Mobil was doing a pilot project with the Ensilage mine in west of Crown Point. I worked in the lab with the engineers, and no matter how hard we tried, we could never get all the uranium out of the water. We closed the project. This is what made me start thinking about the environment, especially our water.
We talked about having a community meeting.
And we decided to do something about it.
We put an article in the newspaper. To our surprise, at our first meeting, close to 50 community members came to that meeting. There were so many people there, a lot of faces I've never seen before. But when we went up there to talk about it, right away we had landowners started to tell us we should stay out of their business. That's their land and they can do whatever they want. It was scary. It was humiliating. It just felt like the whole community just split.
There were people who stood up and accused them of anything from witchcraft to taking food out of the mouths of their grandchildren and standing in the way of people making lots of money off of the uranium leases.
We lost some friends. That's something that was real sad for us. We never wanted that to happen in our community.
This proposal split families. It just didn't split the community. And it didn't split clans. It split blood families.
There were some scary times when we were told, just be careful, just take care of yourself. So I had to really protect my family. That's one of the reasons why Mitchell and I really had to find faith. And 3 years ago, we became members of the Catholic Church.
There's a few families, they own the mineral rights for their land. And then in the distance, you can see the area around where the mining company is. That's owned by a few Navajo families. Those families have been promised huge sums of money by the mining company. And they have been told that this mining process is, quote, safe.
I think when HRI approached my family, the first question was, is it safe? We arranged with the HRI people to actually go to a mine where it's in operation. I even touched some of the uranium that was there, and I read about it. I asked questions a lot. And I think HRI did a good job because they took us down there.
We're not fighting with landowners, allottees. We're fighting with this company.
The mother company of HRI, Uranium Resources, have worked with this technology for 30 years in South Texas. So that experience, that's what they're gonna use here to mine uranium.
With in-situ mining, we drill wells. Whatever goes underground, there are no occupational hazards associated with underground mining and solution mining. In fact, our miners are electric pumps.
We use natural groundwater to leach the uranium. It's brought to the surface, and what we add is we add oxygen and possibly some carbonate, club soda, to the water where it's re-injected into the ground.
The action of pumping dissolved oxygen and sodium bicarbonate into the rocks causes that uranium concentration to increase almost 100,000 times. So you go from very high quality, pristine water, and you make it a toxic soup. Nobody could drink it.
It's safe as long as it's contained, and as you can see here in this jar, it is contained.
So the company has to make sure that none of that stuff escapes, because it's a poison.
The entire well field is circled by monitor wells.
Because the underground buried stream beds are narrower than the distance between the monitor wells, our fear is that a leakage of the mining fluids will escape, go past those monitor wells, and never be detected.
We have experts and hydrologists that have shown that that contamination will reach the drinking wells within less than 7 years. It will, if this mine goes through, destroy the only source of drinking water for 15,000 people.
an excerpt of the documentary Homeland, produced by the Katahdin Foundation. And we're joined here in Albuquerque by Chris Shuey, who is in the film, director of Southwest Research and Information Center, and Winoma Foster, director of ENDALM, Eastern Navajo Diné Against Uranium Mining. We did contact Hydro Resources, but they didn't return our calls. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Can you place this in the country for us? Where are these places that we're talking about, Winoma?
Well, from Albuquerque, it's about 2 hours west of here, in a Navajo community right near Gallup, New Mexico.
And talk about what's happening right now.
As of right now, we're still trying to hold off company Hydro Resources from proposing to mine uranium with a new in-situ leach method that they want to use to extract uranium. And the big issue that lies there right now is that these mining companies are ignoring the Natural Resources Protection Act that was passed within the Navajo Nation government. And with that, we are very concerned, not only because they're ignoring that, our sovereign right to protect our resources and our people, but also because there are past issues that still exist within those communities in Church Rock as far as the need for reclamation of abandoned mines and communities and people, children with their families that live right next to these abandoned mines. Those are the big issues that we still face, and trying to work with communities. Former miners are dealing with health effects and cancer issues and down into compensation issues. So that those are all of the issues that we have to deal with and trying to hold off the mining company.
Krisha, we have, in the country, there is attention now being paid to miners because of what has happened in West Virginia. Can you talk about uranium miners and what has happened over the years, and then how that leads to today and the struggle you're in right now?
Amy, there's been numerous studies of uranium workers and uranium miners, underground miners, throughout the Colorado Plateau over the years. And it's those studies have fairly clearly shown that miners suffer lung cancer and respiratory diseases at much higher rates than the normal population. The Navajo miners are a particularly important subset because they have suffered those same kinds of diseases at much higher rates, disproportionately higher rates than even the rest of the Colorado Plateau miners. And the compensation scheme that the government came up with in 1990 and then amended in 2000 that Winoma talked about has, in our view, discriminated against the Native American miners. There's the Navajo portion of those eligible form about a third of all the Colorado Plateau miners, and yet the total compensation awards for Navajos have run about 11% through September of last year. There are numbers of groups in the Shiprock area headed by a gentleman named Phil Harrison, who's made it his life to try to correct these problems, especially with the Justice Department's implementation of the compensation law. The government doesn't quite get how Navajo and Native American cultures and communities work. And so it's been very difficult for us, many of the old workers, to prove up their claims through things like marriage licenses that never existed. And so those are amongst the human impacts of past mining that are still going on today.
Now, do the miners fall under the same agency as miners that we've been focusing on in places like West Virginia? Our headline today in Mining News, the New York Times reporting the Bush administration has decreased the fines for major mining companies, failed to collect fines on nearly half the mine safety violations issued under its watch. Mine safety regulation has come under increased scrutiny with the deaths of 24 miners. How does that relate?
The Mine Safety and Health Administration also is the regulation entity for underground miners. There are no underground mines operating in the Navajo Nation. There were a few that were reopened here recently as the price of uranium has gone up in Colorado, but I believe that those have been shut down too. If you talk to miners that worked out of Navajo, say in the 1970s, they will tell you over and over again that they don't believe that they were adequately protected even after those same MSHA rules came into effect. And they have a very difficult time understanding and obtaining their old exposure records, and they are not a part of the compensation class. They're ineligible. So there's a whole category of what we call post-1971 uranium miners and mill workers that who may have health problems that cannot get compensation. At this
what
point.
Are the health problems in the communities, Winoma?
We have respiratory illnesses, asthma. There's a rise in asthma, especially with the younger children into the teens, and then also cancer issues. Different types of cancers are affecting people, and then we're also realizing that dependents from former uranium mine workers are also starting to be diagnosed with cancers as well, and diabetes is still a big issue as well.
And the argument, if the mining happens right outside the reservation property?
It's within Navajo Indian country. They can say that it's near an Indian community, Navajo community, but it's right within the jurisdiction of the Navajo Nation and within the communities, Navajo
What are
communities.
You each calling for right now, Chris Shuey?
There's several things that are going on. We have worked with the Navajo Nation to ensure that there's an enforcement strategy for the Dené Natural Resources Protection Act, and it remains to be seen how that will all play out as the companies continue to move forward with their new plans. We are doing a lot of work on the legacy issues, working with Church Rock on environmental assessments in the residential areas near the old mines, working with the community members to assess some of their concerns about health. There have been no major health studies in communities. Lots of information and studies on workers, but not on community members who live near mining. It's a major gap in what we know. It needs to be rectified.
And finally, your final comments. As we talk about what the future will look like.
Well, we hope to continue to protect our resources, our natural resources, which is our, for my own community, an hour north of Church Rock, where they're also proposing uranium mining. Our only source of drinking water provides for 15,000 plus Navajo people, and we don't want any uranium mining whatsoever.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Winoma Foster, director of NDOM, which is the Eastern Navajo Diné Against Uranium Mining, and Chris Shuey, director of the Uranium Impact Assessment Program and Southwest Research Information Center. That does it for today's broadcast. Mosh Now, produced by Mike Berkshire, Hodo Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Ruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Thank you to all the folks here at KNME in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Our website is democracynow.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico, and special thanks to Rahim Al-Haj. I'm Amy Goodman.